You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, December 14th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Jay is unavailable, but he may join us later in the show. We'll see. Depends on when he gets home. So, guys, we lost John Glenn this week. He died right after we recorded the show last week.
The last of the seven.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mercury 7, right? Yeah, man. He had a hell of a run,
and
though.
The most
he
famous.
95?
Yeah, 95. Amazing, amazing life, amazing career. One thing I never really figured out about him, though, is why he only went up once, you know, during the Mercury program.
Yeah.
Like, never
went
up. You think that was his choice?
Was it? Or, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, that was like a very risky trip. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
And the fact that he came back alive, maybe it was his, you know, a pact he made with his wife. Like, if you get back alive, you are never pushing your luck again. Who knows?
But then he did. He went back. He went up in the space shuttle.
That's true.
1998. Yeah. Longest gap between two space flights.
That's right.
Of course.
Oh, that was a big deal.
But of course, by then it was much safer. You know, I think there was a feeling.
I don't know.
That it was much
I don't know about that.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Statistically, two shuttles went up. I mean, I don't think it was safer.
130 launches. Yeah.
Something like that.
That's
true.
But yeah, I mean, he was, you know, one of the few people who you could say was a genuine hero, because absolutely in the early days of NASA, of the space program, every flight was. Was a huge
the
risk.
End, basically.
Yeah.
Right.
Prepare
for the end, folks.
They did, these calculations were done by people, you know, reading up on Hidden Figures and reading up a lot on Katherine Johnson, who is still with us. She and her entire team were making these calculations to send John Glenn into that orbit, into that mission. And computers were just getting online then. And I remember reading that he didn't trust the computers. He wanted to make sure that these amazing women who he had built a lot of trust up with would double check the computer's calculations. Yeah. He wanted the actual human calculators to double check the computer calculations, because that's just how it was back then.
And now there's a new movie coming out. Have you guys seen the preview?
Yeah, that's Hidden Figures.
Awesome.
That's based on
fantastic.
The book. And it's crazy to think, you know, we sometimes talk about, oh, when man first walked on the moon, there was less computing power than we have in our iPhone. When John Glenn went up, we didn't have computers. Like, that's crazy.
They were maybe building the UNIVAC or something like that. It was the day of slide rules and pencil and paper, and that's really all
and
you kind of had.
Rooms full of people doing these calculations. Yeah.
Human brains. He was a U.S. senator from Ohio, served 4 terms.
Oh, wow.
Because people were smarter back then? because they had the foresight to elect scientists and, you know, people owe science into important positions. So, you know, that's a good precedent. I like that and would like to see more of it.
It's very cool.
How about this little factoid, if that's what you want to call it? He flew 149 missions during World War II. 149.
Wow.
And any one of them could have been his last.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
And he lived to the ripe old age of 95. What a life.
All right, Bob, you're going to start us off with Forgotten Superhero of Science.
Yes, for this week's Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I'll be talking about Barbara Liskov. Born in 1938, she is a computer scientist. She was among the first, if not the first, woman to get a computer science doctorate in the United States, and made some fundamental advances in computer programming and languages. Pretty impressive stuff. Liskov essentially invented data abstraction, which is an amazing claim. Which is a critical tool for program organization, and you could just go on and on about it. Her program Clue, CLU, may not be a household term or name, but it was the first to use data abstraction, and pretty much every major language since then, like Java, has borrowed concepts from Clue. Liskov has many, many awards, a very impressive list. She won the John von Neumann Medal for Fundamental Contributions to Programming Languages, Programming Methodology, and Distributed Systems. And in 2008, she won the Turing Award, which is often called the Nobel Prize of Computing. She won for the development of programming languages and methodologies that led to the development of, object-oriented programming. So incredibly impressive career, and she's still going strong. So remember Barbara Liskov, mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing contravariant type constructors, or perhaps referential opacity.
Yeah.
Referential opacity?
Yeah, I love that one. Look those terms up, and it's not technobabble.
Those are two words that make no sense next to each other to me. I've never used those two words together.
All right, well, Kara, tell us about this recent Pew survey about people's attitudes towards food.
Yeah, so, you know, we see these Pew studies, these surveys coming out every so often. This one, I think, was published on December 1st, 2016, and it was collected over a few months during the year, I think May to June. And really, the top line, what they were interested in finding out is how people think or maybe feel, could be a better descriptor of it, about genetic modification, about organic food, and just generally about kind of the relationship between food and health, how important it is to eat healthfully. So there are a ton of things I could get into. The report is 99 pages long. I am definitely not going to read all of the outcomes of this, but there are some kind of top line things that I think are important to jump into. The first one is that a lot of Americans don't seem to care what scientists think about GMOs. You know, there is a general feeling among the public that genetically modified food is not good for you. 39% of the survey participants believe that GM food is worse for your health than non-GM food. And we know that this is simply not true. There's no evidence to support this. There's even a recent conclusion by the National Academies of Sciences that really kind of conglomerates all of the data and says there is no risk to health and human safety by eating GM food. But again, 39% of people think that it is worse for you than non-GM food. And a smaller percentage actually thinks that it's bad for you. But also, almost half of the respondents, so 46% of them, more than the 39% that say it's worse for you than non-GM food, says that they don't really care about the issue of GMOs. So it makes me wonder if this group is simply not interested in being informed, or if they don't think that GMOs have an impact on health, and so the label means nothing to them. But it's funny, because that could be a good sign, or it could be a really, really bad sign, depending on how you interpret this 46%. This is the part that really bothers me. Over 50% of respondents of the survey believe that, quote, about half or fewer of scientists agree that GM foods are safe to eat. So right. This is just a breakdown in science communication.
Yeah, when we know from the Pew surveys last year that 88%, when asked directly, said GMOs are safe, which was higher, by the way, than the 87% who said they believe in man-made global warming. So there's actually, by that survey, by that one survey, there was a stronger consensus on GMO safety than global warming.
Than global warming, exactly. Yeah. And we just know across the board, you know, and we don't have to just pull from this one survey, because there's so much evidence that shows that there's strong scientific consensus that GM foods are safe to eat, and that there's no solid, reproducible evidence that there is a risk to health and human safety. So the fact that over 50% of the respondents of this survey, you know, but that is supposed to be representative of the general public, believe that half or fewer scientists agree that GM foods are safe, that's just a breakdown in communication. There's also a lot of cynicism about the motive of the scientists. Like, here's an interesting point. Americans in this survey feel that the research findings of researchers, their findings are influenced equally by the best available scientific evidence. Yes, we know that that influences scientists. By the desire to help their industries. Uh-oh. And by the desire to advance their careers. So I think that we're seeing a good example of public distrust of science and a public distrust of scientific interest in their careers. And some of this, I wonder how served it is by some of the, let's say, climate denialism rhetoric. You know, we saw a lot during the big push to deny climate change that, oh, these scientists are just trying to further their careers. Oh, they get kickbacks if they say that climate change is happening. So I think there's this really twisted view of, A, how much money scientists actually make, and B, who pays their bill, you know, how they get paid. that's pretty disconcerting there. There seems to be a lot of disconnect between the scientists and what their payroll is, or between the scientists in the public at large and kind of, quote, Monsanto scientists and, you know, that whole, like, boogeyman. This is interesting, too. People do still trust scientists more than politicians, so yay for that. Yeah, 60%, yeah, 60%
that's a
of the
low
public.
Bar, though.
It is a low bar.
Did they compare scientists to pedophiles too?
I mean, I know. Yeah, this one they were just asking that question. So it is weird though. 60% of the respondents want scientists to play a major role in government policies toward GM foods. But come on, that means 40% don't.
Yeah, 40%.
Yeah, so
don't
like
think
about that.
Yeah.
And only 24% of Americans, only a quarter of respondents, want their elected officials to have a major role in these policies.
Gee whiz.
Yeah. So it makes you wonder, like we were just talking about how John Glenn was a senator at an earlier time. And, you know, we bemoan oftentimes that there aren't enough scientists in positions of political, like in legislative roles, for example. Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't seem like the general public wants them there. Okay. Mm-hmm. So to switch gears a little bit. It's interesting because there doesn't seem to be clean party lines when it comes to these ideas about GM food. 39% of Republicans, 40% of Democrats feel that GMOs are worse for people's health in this survey. But more Democrats than Republicans believe that organic foods are healthier. So there is some, you know, we see that sort of the party platform on the Republican side is different than the party platform on the Democratic side with regard to, let's say, GMO labeling. But it does seem like with regards to the individuals who responded on this survey, their political leanings don't really seem to affect whether or not they think GMOs are unsafe. What I don't like about the survey, and Steve, I'm wondering if you're with me on this, it does seem that just stacking a survey where there are a lot of questions about GMOs and a lot of questions about organic food, and then sort of asking them in the same paragraphs creates a false dichotomy that may be fed into these individuals' responses.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I always worry about that. You know, like the sequence of questions. And they try to deal with that by randomizing the order of questions so that – and then seeing if that makes a difference. So that does mitigate it. I mean, Pew knows what they're doing. I mean, they're professionals. But still, it's hard to get away from the influence. That's why there's a whole business of push polling, right? Of polling in such a way that you're actually affecting opinions, not just surveying opinions.
Sure,
that's so true. Yeah,
you can
and
do
Pew,
it deliberately.
I think,
this would be inadvertent. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think Pew actually, you're right, does a good job of trying not to do that and tries to put in tricks so as to avoid that. But in my view, just asking about are GMOs good for you or bad for you? What about organic food? And those being the only top line questions makes it seem like those things are in, you know, it can either be GM, it can either be organic. One of them is good, one of them is bad. I mean, I don't know. So let me see. There is overwhelming consensus. This is actually really funny. 72% of Americans believe that eating healthy, that healthy eating habits are very important in improving one's chances of a long and healthy life. Which again means that 28% of people, I guess, don't think that eating healthy.
Yeah, but that's a tricky one. That is a tricky question, though. You know, like, how would I answer that question? It's like, well, I know what they're getting at, and most people actually assume that diet has a bigger role than it actually has.
That's true, because 25% said it's somewhat important.
Yeah, somewhat. I think I would say so. You might say, well, that's the other thing. What choices do I have? How are they separating it out?
Yeah.
If I say very important, does that mean I think it's more important than it is? And maybe somewhat important captures my view. Yeah, it is important, but it's not as important as some people think. So that's tricky as well.
That is tricky.
Yeah.
It did leave 3% of people, though, who thought that it is not at all important.
That's clearly the wrong answer to say that it's not important. But
those are probably the
nuance.
People who.
Servers like this are not great at capturing nuance. That's the
absolutely. Yeah. There's probably that 3% was probably the people who eat McDonald's every day and somehow go to see their doctors and they're like, you're healthy as a horse.
Yeah. Right.
You know, they're like,
the
dang.
Outliers. Yeah.
But 58% of people say that they fall short of their goals and that, quote, most days I should probably be eating healthier. That doesn't surprise me. I would fall into that 58%
as well. There's a lot of guilt out there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of marketing, too, which I'm sure contributes to that. And then So I think the last thing that is kind of interesting to parse out is, who are these people? You know, what are some of the other demographic features? And can we find neat little camps? And it looks like we can't. When you look closely at these results, we found that there doesn't seem to be a good partisan distinction between these individuals. We also found that there doesn't seem to be a good distinction between, for example, education. The quote-unquote marketing out there for the organic food industry is showing that people who care about being healthy are also likely to eat a lot of organic food, almost three times as likely. The people who described eating healthy as their main focus were almost three times as likely to eat organic food regularly compared to people who are not that concerned about healthy eating. But we don't see a high correlation between people who are really concerned about eating healthy and people who think GMOs are bad for you. So that's a good sign, I think, on the pro-GMO or the science of GMO science communication that's happening out there. But it also shows how important marketing is, because the organic food industry has basically really successfully tied the idea of eating organic food to the idea of eating healthy food, when there's just not good evidence to support that those things are related.
To put all this in perspective, though, I have to point out that last year there was a survey from Oklahoma State University. They found a few interesting things.
Okay.
They found that of those people surveyed, 80% thought that there should be mandatory labeling on food that contains DNA.
Oh my gosh, yes.
That really does put this in perspective. Yeah.
33%, a third, thought that non-GMO tomatoes do not contain any genes.
Oh my gosh.
Wow.
32% thought that vegetables have no DNA.
What?
Well, there you have it.
Oh my goodness.
Wow.
Basic.
Worse than I thought.
Right. So clearly we're dealing with a science literacy issue.
Oh my gosh. At the basic level?
Wow. Yeah.
I wonder how they would feel when you tell them that we have, about 50% of our DNA in common with a banana.
Yeah.
I wonder.
98% or 99% with chimpanzees.
Yeah,
people
but 50%
knew that,
with a banana. Come
if
on,
people
guys.
People knew that. I think, you know, they had more scientific literacy about genes and the nature of genes and evolution and biology and how it's, you know, it's so connected. I think there would be a lot less of this gut feeling fear of GMOs. I think it's based in scientific illiteracy combined with pretty aggressive propaganda marketing campaign.
Scare tactics.
Yeah, a lot of scare tactics. People think that Monsanto is an evil corporation with twisting their mustache. And it's just not true. It's just, they're just another corporation. They're just a regular corporation. Yeah, they do slimy things like all corporations do because they're for profit. But they're not twisting their mustache. All the things they're accused of doing is not true. But you read the comment section to any article about anything to do with anything with food or GMO or whatever, and it's like, but Monsanto's evil, and we can't trust. Mm-hmm. But it's just that's like the level of the discussion that we had. Of course, I'm not saying we should trust corporations. I think we should regulate corporations with science. But
yes.
But the idea that the argument from Monsanto, it's like, yeah, but Monsanto's evil, you know.
Yeah, but Monsanto.
And the argument that all GM research was conducted by Monsanto it's just not true. Yeah. There's a ton of, you know, public university research.
Yeah, about half.
Half the research is funded by you. Like, it's important to know that and to be reading it and to try and understand why there is scientific consensus on this. That said, it's easy, I think, for the propaganda to take hold because, just like you said, the scientific literacy isn't there. And these terms, you know, genetically modified,
scary.
Transgenic, they sound scary.
That's scary.
Doesn't help that the media doesn't do a good job of defending that. They do a really bad job of playing into it. It is not uncommon to see an article, you know, talking about GM foods, and the photo that is chosen for the article is a tomato with a, you know,
needle
hypodermic syringe.
The hypodermic, I hate
exactly.
That picture. It has nothing to do with what happened.
It has nothing, no.
Almost a meme. No one is
and
sticking
it's weird.
Needles into tomatoes.
No. And if you look it up,
it's not even the right image. Yeah.
It's pathetic.
If you look in a stock photography database, which I've had to do working as a journalist to pick the images that go along with it, if you search for GMO or genetically modified organism, you don't really find any positive images.
Yeah.
And the majority of the ones you find are crazy, like a head of lettuce with teeth.
Yeah, right.
What is that?
It's Frankenfood. Imagery.
It's Frankenfood. Yep, yeah. That's what people think.
All right, let's move on. Have you guys ever heard of cryogenic energy storage?
Yeah. Bob has.
I have. I've heard of all of those words separately.
I can all define right. all Listen, those words.
I was, you know, I think I had heard of it, but I didn't really know what it was, and I learned about it recently. This is an interesting news item, but I'm going to back up a little bit and talk about grid energy storage in general. So the idea is to store lots of energy that is produced by power plants in some kind, something that functions like a battery, right? Stores energy so that it can be released back to the grid as needed. This could have a huge benefit on the functionality of our grid because, you know, power companies have to match production and demand. And demand has peaks and troughs. It generally peaks around 6 to 7 p.m. It obviously depends on time of year, et cetera. And then reaches a trough at around, you know, 2 to 4 a.m. People aren't using a lot of electricity in the wee hours of the morning. So they need to have base load, base production of energy, and then they need to have on-demand energy that they can produce when during peak demand. And of course, they use the most efficient and cleanest, you know, energy for the baseload energy, and then they tend to bring online more expensive, less efficient, and sometimes dirtier energy for peak demand. Partly the reason for that is that the energy that they bring on as needed needs to come on quickly. So that's the feature that they need. They need to emphasize the feature of we could turn this on quickly. It's not necessarily this is really efficient once you get it running, you know. So like a nuclear power plant, those things don't turn on and off very quickly. You know, those are baseload producers. But other types of energy, like fossil fuel plants, for example, you could turn on and off more quickly. Okay. Batteries would flatten out the curve, right? If you could store the energy that you produce during off-peak to release to use during peak, then you could have just essentially mostly or all baseload production using the most efficient, the cheapest, and hopefully the cleanest energy. So the problem is getting more acute because of intermittent green energy production, right? So solar and wind are great because they're clean, but they're intermittent. You know, the sun shines when it shines and the wind blows when it blows. They're not on demand and they're not continuous. So they're helpful, obviously. They could add to the overall energy production, but they can't be counted on for base load production, nor can they be counted on for on-demand peak, you know, production. They really just exist when they do. In order for them to really have an impact on the infrastructure, we will need to store the energy they produce to be released as needed, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We want to get to a significant percentage. Okay, so what are our options? What are the options for massive grid energy storage? And it's interesting. It's an interesting question. So one that I learned about in detail recently is the cryogenic storage. The way this works is when you produce, and all these things work, but like basically when you're producing energy, you use that energy to do something that stores energy, and then you can release that energy later. So you just think, what could you do with that energy that would put it into a form that it could later be used? With cryogenic energy storage, what they do is they use the energy to essentially liquefy air. They cool air until you get essentially liquid nitrogen.
Ooh.
And then when they could allow that liquid nitrogen to warm up, it expands into a gas, right? And then that expanding gas turns a flywheel.
Right. Oh, and that expansion is 700 fold, which is pretty much the most important thing about it.
Wow.
One of them.
But how much energy does it take to do that?
Yeah. So, all right. So when you talk about the question you're asking, Kara, is what is the round trip efficiency? The round trip efficiency means when you go from energy to storage and then storage back to the grid, what is the loss, you know, of the energy? So for cryogenic storage, it's about 50%, which is not great.
It's not great.
So you basically lose half the energy. Now, they say, the scientists who are trying to scale this up say they hope they're going to get it up to 60 to 70% or more, but that's just a hope, right? Right now, there are cryogenic facilities working, and they have about a 50% round trip efficiency. So that's not horrible, not great, not the kind of thing that you want to use for a lot of the grid. Now, some people argue that if you have that kind of energy storage tied to a solar, you know, sort of voltaics, it doesn't matter that much because it's energy you wouldn't be having anyway. You're producing all of the energy clean without producing any CO2. And therefore, even if you're losing half of it, you still have all that energy from the solar power that you wouldn't otherwise have that could be released during peak. And that's true. That energy is very valuable at peak energy. In fact, there are companies that all they do is buy energy off peak, store it, and then sell it back during peak. And you
could, my God.
You could make money doing that as long as your efficiency is high enough.
Yeah.
And, you know, the cryogenic storage at 50%, I think it's kind of borderline in terms of whether that would be efficient. Okay, but what are some of the other options? I don't think that the cryogenic storage, as sexy as it sounds, is, unless they really do get the efficiency up to 80% like they hope, unless they really do, I don't think it's going to be a really good solution. What about batteries, right? Batteries are your basic solution. Well, the best batteries we have now, how efficient do you think they are?
15%.
And is this that same
70.
Like
they're actually pretty good.
Oh, actually it's good.
And this is that round trip efficiency 60 that you're talking
to 70%. Yeah, round trip. We're all talking about from now on I'm always going to be talking about round trip efficiency.
So I can be clear, that is just basically a net number. It doesn't matter if we're talking about energy loss through leakage or if we're talking about necessitating outside energy in order to store the energy. It's just a round trip number.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
However, it's a round trip number, but some forms of stored energy will lose it over time. So that round trip efficiency depends on what the delay is.
Gotcha.
For example, cryogenic storage, you got to keep that liquid nitrogen cool. And if you have to store it in that form for a month and then release it, the efficiency obviously is a lot less than if you're storing it for just 5 hours. But, you know, usually you're going to offset, you know, if you're going from trough to peak, you're only offsetting by about 14 or 15 hours, right? So it will tend to be used in that fashion. Okay. And we'll mention that as a factor as well. Uh-huh. Batteries are good in a lot of ways. They're they 60 to 70% is reasonably efficient, not the most efficient option we have, but it's pretty good. There's also another factor, and that is how quickly can this format release the energy. So a lot of the stored energy turns a turbine and then generates energy, and that's okay, but there's a little bit of a ramp up time. Batteries have millisecond response time. So they're the fastest in terms of like, boom, you need the energy. There it is. It's right there. So the problem with batteries is building enough batteries, you know, big enough cheaply without using toxic materials to have, you know, enough storage that it has an effect. So that's we don't have battery technology right now.
So they may be really efficient, but they're just not that powerful.
Yeah. They just don't have the
diamond batteries.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Those are
radioactive diamond batteries.
The radioactive diamond batteries are really a power source, not really a way of storing power. But okay.
True.
All right. Next
what
one.
Else?
Flywheel. You spin up a flywheel.
Yeah.
And then to store the energy, and then when you want to get the energy back, it obviously turns a turbine, which generates electricity. Mechanical bearing flywheels have a horrible efficiency. Again, they're about 50%.
Oh, God.
Not great. However, an optimal system with magnetic bearings in a vacuum.
Yes.
In a vacuum.
Okay. In a vacuum.
85 to 90% round trip.
Damn.
Efficiency.
Talking.
Now
in a vacuum.
Yeah, it's right. So there's a huge
that low. I expected a little higher.
85 to 90%. But even with like minimizing friction, they still will slow down over time. So they're not good for storing energy for a long time. You know, you get up to like 50,000 RPMs
in a vacuum on a magnetic field. Why would
it doesn't matter, right?
Because there's still some resistance, and so it slows. You lose energy. It leaks energy over time. So it wouldn't store energy for a terribly long time. But again, if you're using it to just shift for 14 hours or whatever, that should be fine. right?
Can we build a vacuum big enough to hold on to these flywheels? Oh, okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was like a theoretical thing.
No, no. All of the things I'm talking about exist. These all exist. I haven't told you about the best one yet, though. I'll save that for last. I think is the best one. So the flywheel is a good option. I think they're a little expensive to build, and these might be good for like a building, you know, or a company, but I don't know that this is going to be an option for massive grid storage.
Yeah, right. I agree. Yeah.
There's compressed air.
So many.
You can compress air and then uncompress it to turn a turbine. If you could, for example, have a massive underground cave or cavern that you could seal off and you can compress air into it, you could store lots of energy. But what do you think the round trip efficiency is?
No.
I think it would leak.
Compressing and then releasing.
I feel like it would leak.
45%. Not very good.
Okay. 40.
Yeah.
Not good.
Mm. Yeah. So not great. Huh. Okay, so hydrogen is another method. You could use electricity to split water into hydrogen and oxygen. You store the hydrogen, then you burn it back to oxygen to make the energy when you need it in a fuel cell, right?
I like that.
Yeah,
one.
Fuel cell.
Mm-hmm. Round trip efficiency?
70%.
30%.
Yeah, it's 70%.
What is it,
30?
30%, damn low.
No hydrogen economy for us.
Never mind.
Yeah, right. But people will say, yeah, but if you have it attached to a solar, you know, photovoltaic panel, it's free. It's free energy, basically. Just getting from the sunlight. You know, I wouldn't burn coal to hydrolyze.
Right.
That would not.
Yeah.
Be,
right. Sure. Well, that's the same with the cryogenic idea.
Yeah.
That's true. Like how you lose the energy matters. You know, I mean, this round trip efficiency number is important, but it definitely seems like it matters if we're having to produce the energy somehow from, you know, a non-efficient source, or if we can just do it from the sun.
Right. So this is the leaf concept, where you have sunlight is splitting hydrogen, you know, off of water and getting energy out of it. Yeah, and if you could have a system that efficiently did that, even if it's not that efficient overall, it's a new way to cleanly make energy. There's an advantage to hydrogen in that it's portable, theoretically. You know, so we could use it in cars, could use it, store it in your home for a hydrogen fuel cell to make electricity locally, which has an efficiency there. If you're not transmitting it after it's put back in the grid, there's a certain savings there. So this may have a function. It would be nice if we can get that 30% efficiency up, though, you know, because that's pretty low. That's pretty
low. It's low, but yeah, in the grand scheme of things, it really just has to be high enough to serve our needs.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be like 100% efficient. And the nice thing about hydrogen, the nice thing about even like you were saying, compressed air, things like that, these are renewable resources.
Yeah.
Or I guess they're just everywhere.
Yeah.
We're not going to run out, which is
right,
nice.
Right. So, okay, here's what I think so far is probably the best option for massive grid storage. Mm-hmm. Do you guys have a guess, by the way? If you didn't read my post about it already.
I didn't read it. I was hoping one of them would like, be a hamster in a wheel. But
hamster in a wheel. Yeah.
Like heating up like a salt.
Well, that's a good one, too. Heating the salts, but that's not very efficient either. So pumped hydro. Pumped water, right? Very simple.
Water.
Call it pumped hydro. Basically, you have two reservoirs separated by a dam. Or they don't have to, doesn't have to be a dam. You just have a low reservoir and a high reservoir. You pump water from low to high against gravity. That's how you store the energy. And then you have a hydroelectric plant. You release the water from the high, you know, level to the low level to produce energy for the grid.
So you're like using potential energy then.
Potential energy. Exactly.
Wow.
Just storing the energy.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It happens in your body. This is cool.
Yeah.
It's in the human body.
Yeah.
Right.
It's clean. We already have hydroelectric, you know, power plants technology.
Mm-hmm.
So efficiency, round trip efficiency is 80%, which is damn good.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah, 80%. And of course, you know, if you have a big enough reservoir of water, you could store lots of energy this way. This could really be a significant impact on the grid. So in the United States, we already have pumped hydro energy storage facilities, and enough to meet 2% of our electricity demand. Not a lot.
Okay.
2% is not a lot. Europe overall on average has 5%. Japan, 10%.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
There are plans to build more pumped hydro stations to double that number, I think by 20 or something, to get up to 4%. But still, why don't we have 20%, you know?
Yeah, that's
why isn't this 30%? If you can get it up to numbers like that, then
can we? I mean, aren't you limited by kind of like geography and natural resource type things, right?
Well, yeah, I imagine that was a question for me.
Yeah.
Can you use salt water?
Yeah, why not?
Okay, cool. I didn't know if maybe like the salt would, you know, gum up any of the
Flowing over a turbine. No.
Yeah, so that really helps, right? I could understand like in California we wouldn't want to invest in something like that because we have a massive water shortage, but we're also right on the ocean. So if we could build something like this using ocean water, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
Sure.
And we already have, guys, we already have tons of hydroelectric plants that have this situation where they have a high level and a low level.
Right, like Niagara Falls. I mean, that's the same idea.
Oh, yeah.
Using the potential energy.
Yeah. I mean, God, there's a dozen of them I drive past around Connecticut where I live, right, guys?
Connecticut has them. Absolutely.
Yeah, there's all kinds of reservoirs. And the other thing is the reservoirs can be used. They could be used for fishing and, you know, and wildlife and everything. It's not like it's just isolated or something. Yeah, they could serve double duty.
You could do this with like a wastewater plant. You could actually put it, like involve it in a plant that's already existing.
Yeah.
Like that's interesting because there's a lot we have to do with our water anyway to process it.
You just need water and someplace to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. Build it in such a way that we get energy back out of it.
But Bob, you're right. I could not find, and I'm sure there are people who know more about this than I do. I could not find any reference that said like what was the potential for that. Like if we try to identify locations or like how difficult is it to build a reservoir? Because there's a lot of man-made lakes in Connecticut, you know, that just completely man-made. In fact, Candlewood Lake, which is right by our home, is one of the largest man-made lakes in the world. I think it's like number three.
Neat.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And yeah, completely man-made, and it's a reservoir that's used for hydroelectric. So fine. You know, you can easily just store power by pumping water up into the higher reservoir. That's, you know.
And is it also a recreational lake?
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, cool. That's awesome.
Totally, totally recreational, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you have, we have those everywhere. We've got lakes everywhere that aren't, you know, they're being used as like we said, for recreation. They're being used for fishing.
Yeah.
But why not also get energy out of them?
Exactly. So I do wonder what the potential is for this if we really identified all the locations that we could
use. Yeah, without even making new ones, just retrofitting other locations.
Yeah, and if we could get up to that 20-30% figure, that could totally level out. Totally level out our energy demand.
It's just not. It's not sexy enough for me.
See,
okay.
No,
well,
I love the fact that it's so simple.
I sound like a politician right now.
I need gee whiz cool shit feeling, not hydro, pumped hydro.
No, sometimes the simplest solution is the best one.
Bob, quantum nano storage cells. How about those? that's totally sexy.
Yeah.
Quantum baby. Yeah.
Dihydrogen monoxide storage.
Yeah, right. There you go, Bob. How's that?
Right. A fascinating topic. I'm endlessly fascinated by the whole energy infrastructure thing.
Yeah.
But this is cool to look at all the options and what the efficiencies were. And yeah, it turns out like one of the simplest things is probably the best, you know? And we already have the technology. It's just a matter of just doing it at this point. All right, let's move on. Bob, this is another sort of tech. This is a high tech fix you're going to like, right, Bob? This is right up your alley. Tell us how Japan is planning to fix our space junk problem.
Well, I'll say space junk is in the news again. Yes, we're going to talk about space junk again, but I think I'm maybe a little bit more nervous than ever based on my research. And this is cool. This is cool and all, but it's very niche. So Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, JAXA, has launched something new into space to test a new space junk mitigation technology. And they're using a tether powered by Earth's magnetosphere to deorbit large pieces of space junk. So interesting technology. It's a cool idea. It's known as KITE, K-I-T-E, the Kunotori Integrated Tether Experiment. The key bit of tech here, of course, is what's called the electrodynamic tether, and it took 10 years to properly create this thing. It's 700 meters long, the test tether anyway, made by a company that makes fishing nets and stuff, and it's made out of stainless steel and aluminum. So it's interesting. So the idea is that, well, actually, the supply ship went to the space station to drop off some interesting things like some new batteries and other things, food, I'm sure. When that supply ship leaves, the ship will unfurl this tether to see if it can do the job of generating electricity by interacting with Earth's magnetic field and essentially dragging itself to lower orbit to test that it can actually kind of force it to deorbit. So if this works, so this test goes well, eventually the plan would be to attach a 5,000 or 10,000 meter tether, much larger, to large bus-sized pieces of space junk to deorbit them. So that's the ultimate plan. So should you care? Yes. These huge pieces of space junk, they are dangerous. Not only could they hit something important, other satellites, potentially even the space station. If something hits them, they have the potential to create tons and tons of extra space junk that we don't have. So instead of having one big space junk, you could literally have thousands of little pieces of space junk all traveling with amazing kinetic energy, able to do terrible damage. So should you still be pissed? And I say yes, because we are not doing enough about this. This is this plan that they have, if it works, is really only going to work for the large stuff. And there's just way too many tiny things that this thing cannot address at all. NASA and the Department of Defense of the United States are tracking 500,000 pieces of space junk, and only 20,000 of them are larger than a softball. So that's a lot that are tiny and deadly. The European Space Agency has estimated that there may be, get this, 170 million pieces of man-made space junk, an amazingly gargantuan number. The vast majority is tiny, and Kite, like I said, Kite could do nothing about them. But the problem here is kind of obvious. It's the relative velocity. You know, the different orbits around the Earth have vastly different relative velocities. So many, many thousands of miles per hour, you know, 17,000 miles an hour difference is what the number I keep running across. So that means that kinetic energy of a tiny paint chip can be huge. So there are cracks in the windows of the space station right now that have been attributed to paint chips. Think of a paint chip. This thing almost cracked the glass of the window of the space station.
We need better shielding.
Oh my God. So the European Space Agency wrote in May, an object up to 1 centimeter in size could disable an instrument or a critical flight system on a satellite. Anything above 1 centimeter could penetrate the shields of the station's crew module. So that's dead astronauts. Anything larger than 10 centimeters could shatter a satellite or spacecraft into pieces. Think about it. 10 centimeters. That's tiny. And that thing is, there's these deadly 10 centimeter weapons that are just flying in orbit right now. Tens and hundreds, thousands of them. So there are some people who believe that we have already entered a scary threshold known as Kessler syndrome. That means that there's enough interacting debris up there to increase the number of separate, distinct things, even if we stop launching right now. If we don't launch anything and just sit here and do nothing and just look up at the sky, the number, and we count what's up there, people believe that it's increasing. So the
of course, you know, because things are colliding and breaking.
Right. And the natural deorbiting will not decrease the number that's up there, because you would think, oh, over time, you know, things slowly decay, their orbit decays, they deorbit, and the number goes down, but we're not there. I mean, it's increasing, and they're, you know, so that means that it's becoming increasingly dangerous in orbit. The more we just really don't do much about it. And the worst case scenario is pretty horrific. We're talking about a cascade of collisions that literally destroys everything in orbit. Everything gone, done. $1 trillion worth of hardware that makes modern society what it is could be gone within a couple weeks.
But Bob, wouldn't that happen like at low Earth orbit, but not really affect, say, geosynchronous orbit?
Steve, there's a lot of stuff in geosynchronous orbit. Why wouldn't it happen? I know that's really far. It's really far away, but I mean, there's a lot of stuff there. So,
but because it's locked, right?
Well,
it's not crashing into each other.
Yeah, by definition, geosynchronous, it's not. I mean, I don't know enough about how the different orbits work to say which orbits might be worse off.
As long as we're all moving in the same direction, right? You just don't want things. The problem with the low Earth orbit, there's so much stuff there. And some of that, it was the result of collisions or blowing up stuff, that there's stuff moving in different directions.
Right. Yeah. So geosynchronous might be safer, but ultimately a worst case scenario is horrible. I mean, we would not be able to launch anything for potentially centuries. Yeah. We can't do anything. Yeah, right.
That's
right.
What I was thinking, the Wall-E
right
scenario.
Hey, Steve, real quick. I did a quick look up on the, space junk and, geosynchronous orbit. There are rockets that have transfer orbits that go through those orbits. So they are not immune, even though they have a fixed position.
All right.
They are not as immune as you might think. So
yeah, it's too bad. Okay.
Yeah.
Kara, what's the word this week?
Ooh, the word this week is an interesting one because it is a word where the etymology, I think, actually defines it best. The word is in situ, and I thought it would be an interesting one because, you know, I use this term a lot when I was doing science, and it's a term that many people will come across if they want to read the source literature, but may not know what it means because it's very jargony. And there's a lot of other terms that are similar to it, so I wanted to clear all of that up. First, I'll start with the etymology. It's a Latin term, as it sounds, was first written in the mid-1700s, and it literally translates to in its place, in its position. And we generally think of that as being its original place or its original position. So in sight, in place, in position. So what does that mean when it comes to science or medicine or any of these other fields? It depends on what we're talking about. Oftentimes in science, we use in situ, like let's say archaeology or paleontology is a good example of that. If we find an artifact and we leave it in the place where it was found so we can study all of the context around it, then we're studying that artifact in situ. If we are looking at functional biology and we want to look at the brain of a mouse and see how a certain aspect of its brain works, if we want to study it in the living mouse without changing it or pulling it away from where it originally was found, we're studying it in situ. You see this a lot of times in other fields. You can see it in computer science, you can see it in atmospheric sciences, even in economics, in, you know, industry. In law, you see the word in situ used. And I'm looking here at an example, in situ land exchange. That would be land that is, you know, owned where it lies. You see it used in literature. In medicine, Steve, you've probably used this before. Like a tumor could be an in situ tumor. If it hasn't metastasized, it hasn't invaded, it hasn't moved, it's kind of where it originally lied. And so I thought I would bring it up in comparison to some other terms that you'll sometimes see, like in vitro or in vivo, because they also have those Latin roots and sometimes they're related. When you hear the term in vivo, that means in life, right, in the living organism. And so a good example would be you want to look at electrical activity. So you drop an electrode into the brain of a mouse. You're studying that activity in vivo. If you want to study it outside of the animal, that's what I used to do when I was doing my research. We made monolayer neuronal cell networks where we took fetal mouse tissue out of the animal, put them on these plates, and grew them in incubators. That was in vitro experimentation. You might also sometimes hear that referred to as ex vivo, outside of the living animal.
And in vitro literally translates to in glass.
Oh, that's fascinating. Because, yeah, we don't always do in vitro experiments in glass, but many of them are.
But that's what it means, yeah.
That's fascinating. And then you'll also sometimes hear ex situ, just like you might hear ex vivo. And that simply refers to taking that thing out of its original place in an effort to study it. So especially with, again, going back to archaeology or paleontology, maybe we take something and we put it in a scanner in order to study it. Well, now we're studying it ex situ because it's no longer in the original place where we found it. So we cannot use context from that original resting location. Weirdly, when I started to read about it, I noticed that a lot of sites say that the American pronunciation of in situ is in situ, which is crazy to me because I've never heard a single person.
I have heard that.
You have heard that.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Sounds like
so if you hear it, if you hear it referred to as in situ, apparently that's an alternative American pronunciation of that. But most European pronunciations, and from what I've gathered, every professor I've ever heard say it out loud always said in situ. But I love these terms because these are the types of terms that we often read but have never heard anyone say. So it's good to hear it spoken out loud. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good one. I like that one.
Yeah.
All right, a couple of emails, both follow-ups to last week. So last week in one of the science or fictions, it was about the super premium gas. You guys remember that one?
Yes.
And we talked about what premium gas ordinarily refers to. And I gave kind of a quickie description of it, and a lot of people wrote in. We got a lot of email about this. People wanted to explain exactly what it means. It's interesting. So I thought it would be a good opportunity just to give a more of a detailed description. So to back up a little bit to explain what is the advantage of premium gas, you know, how basically an internal combustion engine works. There's a cylinder that fills up with gas and air, and then the piston compresses that, and then a spark plug ignites it, which causes it to explode, which then moves the piston back out. And every time the piston moves in and out, that's turning a crankshaft, which is eventually turning the wheels. So that's essentially how the engine works. And you're using the energy of the gasoline to essentially propel that piston, which then moves up and down. So in order to keep everything working optimally, the spark plug goes off at the optimal point of compression, and then you get one single solid explosion of the gas-air mixture. However, if you compress that mixture enough, it will spontaneously explode. And so the engines are designed so that the spark plug goes off before that happens. If one part of the fuel explodes spontaneously, then that causes knocking or pinging, right? In fact, sometimes you can get like two waves, like the spark plug goes off and then somewhere else there's also an explosion and then they hit each other. And this is over time, knocking can damage the engine. So you don't want that. So this relates to the octane rating, because the octane rating, which is what determines if something is premium, right? So for like regular gasoline has an octane rating maybe of 87, and then premium might be 89, or extra premium, you know, could be 91 octane rating. And that's the ratio of isooctane to heptane. The higher the percentage, you know, that is the octane, then the higher the octane rating. Now, octane is less explosive, if you will, than the heptane. So the higher the octane rating, the higher the compression that the gas-air mixture can tolerate before it spontaneously explodes. So if you have a high compression engine that compresses the gas more before the spark plug goes off, you need higher octane fuel so that it won't spontaneously explode before the spark plug. And the reason why you would have a high compression engine is so that you can get more power out of a smaller engine. Because, you know, if you compress the air more before it explodes, you get more energy out of that explosion. And so you can have a smaller engine producing more horsepower. So high performance, meaning high compression engines, need a higher octane rating so they don't knock or ping.
Meaning fancy cars.
Yeah, you don't get the premature explosion. So is there any advantage to premium fuel in a regular engine that is not high compression? No, there is zero benefit because it's already going to not knock and ping, right? It's the spark plug will go off before compression causes spontaneous explosion. But it's only in the higher compression cars that you need the higher octane rating to, you know, because that has a lower potential to explode. So you just basically need to match your octane rating to your vehicle. For most vehicles, the regular gas is fine. For high compression engines specifically, you need the higher octane rating. The user manual will probably tell you.
Yeah, user manual.
Yeah.
It's all there.
Yeah.
Ugh, I'm so glad I have an electric car.
Yeah. There is zero benefit to using premium gas in a regular engine that's not, you know, high compression. Cool. It's a nice little story that fits together well. I like it. Okay, we also got a lot of feedback from last week's show regarding the interview with Marty Klein on pornography. And it's been kind of on both sides. A lot of people liked it. A lot of people were disappointed that we didn't push back more against Marty on some of the things that he said. Well, one thing I found interesting, Kara, you tell me what you think about this. So a lot of people said only Kara really questioned what he was saying and you guys didn't. Which I thought was a little odd. To me, it struck me as if, like, you're not part of the interview or you weren't part of the SGU. Mm-hmm. Like, you were just sort of on your own. But you know, you're part of the SGU. You're part of the interview. I take into consideration what everyone is saying. I thought you did a fine job of bringing up your side, your perspective of pornography. And there was an interesting discussion, and there you go. I thought it was fine.
Yeah. I think how I read most of the emails that came in that did kind of make that distinction, like only Kara did this and the guys didn't. I don't think they were saying like only Kara and the SGU didn't. I think they were saying the men didn't. I think they were trying to make a distinction between me being female and trying to, in some way, sort of defend a female position. I think the biggest concern was that many people thought that Marty just kind of plowed through any of my concerns and sort of either didn't really give them their due or minimized what they were or kind of strawmanned me a little bit when I would say, yeah, don't you think that this is maybe a little bit humiliating towards women? He would be like, well, let's talk about spanking. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not talking about spanking. That's really not, you know, what I'm expressing.
Yeah, we didn't want to get too graphic there.
Yeah.
So the point was that you thought that there's a lot of, in standard pornography, there's a lot of scenes that are humiliating towards women. And Marty's point was that, well, most people do not go out of their way to consume pornography that depicts humiliation by their perspective, and that what is humiliating is subjective. So what's interesting is what I typically do when I have the opportunity is I will often watch interviews that people we're going to interview have done, so I know what they have to say for themselves. I know what questions to ask. So I watched like an hour-long interview with Marty before we did our interview. So I already knew what his position was. And what's interesting is looking back, it's like, yeah, I didn't ask him to clarify maybe as much as I would have because I knew exactly what he was saying because he had already spelled it out entirely in a very long interview. So I knew what he was saying. And I did email Marty after we got the email feedback just to see how he would respond, to see if he had anything he wanted to clarify or to add. So just to let me summarize what, you know, his position is. Because I think you guys were talking about two different things. Marty is not saying that there isn't pornography that depicts scenes that are humiliating to women. He wasn't saying that. What he's saying is that if you look at the statistics, most men, most people who are consuming pornography are not looking for scenes of humiliation or violence or degradation or or spanking or whatever. Yes, some people do. Yes, it's there. But that's not what people are looking for mostly. And I did ask him for evidence, and he gave me several references, which I'll include in the notes, one of which is Pornhub, which apparently is the largest aggregator of pornography sites on the internet.
Is that right, Bob?
And I looked it up. They publish their search results. Like, this is what people are searching on every year. You could go to Pornhub search results, and you could look at yourself. And, yeah, I mean, no one's looking for, you know, rim shot or whatever, the money shot or the stuff that you would consider humiliating. The other thing I found interesting, Kara, is that I completely agree with you in terms of, which is why I think Marty was saying, yeah, most guys don't want to watch that kind of stuff. The other point is that it's all there and it's all categorized and people could find whatever they want. So there was some interesting discussion about like how quote unquote difficult is it to find pornography that does not contain any of that because it is nicely and conveniently categorized.
So yeah. And I think I think that was really my concern, that didn't seem like we really were able to get into it that much because he was making the arguments that the scientific evidence really supports that porn doesn't breed violence and most people aren't looking for violence in porn. And if you watch porn, you're not going to go out and commit more violence. And I don't think anybody was arguing with that.
That's where he was coming from. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think my more nuanced question was, if you're searching for porn, even if you're not directly for searching like humiliation porn, you will often encounter humiliating scenes in what is defined more traditionally as just typical porn. And how a man might define a scene of humiliation might be a little different than how a woman might define it. And so just assuming that watching a certain thing and saying, well, I'm not looking for humiliation, you might still be getting it and that might still normalize it. And that's really the issue that I was most concerned about. Mm. Yeah.
And I agree. I agree. You will stumble upon it even if you're not looking for it. I've always chalked that up to that's just the porn industry culture.
Yeah. And I think it's the nature of porn being geared towards men. You know, I think that's a big
part. I don't know if that's what it is or not. I don't know if maybe I don't know. I mean, I don't like any of that, so it's hard for me to say.
Yeah.
It's interesting you said that you watch lesbian porn because lesbian porn doesn't have any of that, and I think a lot of guys watch lesbian porn for the exact same reason. And that is,
I think so.
Lesbians always the number one choice on search. You know, so I looked at it when I looked it up. Lesbians right there at the top, which is interesting. But I think that it may not be that men want that and they're gearing it towards men. It could just be that this is what people who make porn videos think people want. You know, it's just the culture.
Exactly,
like
which is such a problem.
You know, there are Hollywood tropes.
Yeah.
So I think it may have something to do more with that they think you got to have the money shot, you know, but even though I don't think people really want it is the bottom line. And if you, again, Marty's only point was if you actually look at the data, people aren't going out of their way to find that sort of stuff. But yeah, you're right. It doesn't mean it's not there.
Yeah, and of course, I was probably asking many questions that don't have data to support them. This is such an interesting field of inquiry because, at least in American culture, it's extremely taboo. And it makes you wonder how much data is really out there and how much of this do we have to make assumptions based on, which can be a little bit dangerous and unscientific. So I was probably asking about nuanced questions that may not have any data to back them up. And so he wanted to keep sticking with, well, what we do know is porn doesn't make you commit violent crimes. And it's like, yeah, okay. That's fair.
Yeah, somebody complained that he made a correlation causation argument, but I knew that he wasn't doing that. He was just saying the data doesn't support that the availability, the widespread, you know, availability of pornography, you know, has not increased divorce or violence or sexual abuse or whatever. It hasn't increased any of these things because these things have all been decreasing since porn has been widely available. He wasn't making the other argument that porn is decreasing those things. He did not make that argument.
No,
and
he
in fact,
didn't say that.
He
specifically
said
that,
said that.
He, like yeah. twice. Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah, he's well aware of that trap.
Yeah. He said it. He's careful about that one.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think in retrospect, I always try to do a post-mortem on my own interview style. And I think I have to be aware of the fact that just because I know what the person is saying doesn't mean I shouldn't be attuned to the need for clarification, especially when there was an apparent disagreement about what was going on.
It's a topic we don't generally cover on the show, and it's a topic that makes people wiggle a little bit. And so I think that there was also a little bit of feedback that I noticed in emails, just that the guys, meaning the four of you, not me, were a little quieter than usual during the discussion and sort of let me get out in front of some of the things that I was concerned about and talk about them. But I don't think that should be a knock against you guys.
Yeah. When we're interviewing somebody, I think of us collectively. As long as somebody makes the point, I feel we've made the point.
Exactly.
But whatever.
Yeah, right, I agree. Right, exactly. I feel the same way. We don't need to parse it out that way.
Yeah, I mean, from my point of view, I mean, just in general, you, Steve and Carrie, you guys are you're fantastic at interviews, but it's hard to match you in a lot of ways because you just come up with these great comments and questions so fast, and I'm thinking about it, I'm like, oh yeah, I was just going to say that. And that doesn't happen a lot, but it does happen. So you guys are tough to be in group interviews with.
I could see that. Yeah. Well, and it's what I do for a living. You know what I mean? So I probably bring that with me.
You just bring so much to the interview. It's like, holy crap.
I know. Sometimes I try to pause, let you guys jump in there, but I also feel like I need to keep the interview moving along, you know?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah,
right.
For sure.
It's unusual. A lot of shows don't have four or five people interviewing one person. I mean, that's uncommon.
That's true.
We do the best we can. I think it's interesting to have all of our voices there, but it is a little hard to manage. It is a little hard to manage at times.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. The theme is education. These are all news items about education. Are you ready?
Yes.
Yes.
Here we go. A study of college students finds an inverse relationship between mood and academic achievement, with those reporting more stress and negative emotions performing better than their happy peers. All right, number two, a new study finds that most undergraduate students do not improve their problem-solving skills after the first semester. And item number three, researchers find that children who gesture more or were encouraged to gesture more are more creative than those who gesture less. Evan, go first.
An inverse relationship between mood and academic achievement. Those reporting more stress and negative emotions performing better than their happy peers. Well, that could be. Stress is not a an all bad thing. I mean, I imagine too much stress is bad or can be bad, but it actually is a motivating factor and does help people be productive. So I think that one's going to turn out to be right. The second one, undergraduate students do not improve problem-solving skills after the first semester. You would have the tendency to maybe think that this is right. The student is just kind of getting used to the whole shift culturally and personally and every other way of being in the college environment, which I know, at least personally speaking, was a big deal for me. And it did take a lot of adjusting on my part sort of to do this, to go through that adjustment as well. But I'm not sure that it really has to inhibit their problem solving. Maybe it might even make it better because obstacles that you haven't had to deal with earlier in your life have come up, and therefore you have to find a way to sort of plow through it. So I have a feeling that one will likely be the fiction. Just real quick on the last one, children who gesture more, encouraged to gesture more, more creative than those who gesture less. I don't know too much about this, but I don't see any real problem with that. But the one about problem solving after the first semester, I think that one's going to be the fiction.
Evan, let me make sure that you're interpreting that the way that I intended, because it is a little tricky. So what the data shows, if this one's correct, is that the problem solving improved during the first trimester, but then after the first trimester, through the rest of their undergraduate education, it did not improve. Is that how you interpreted it?
Or similar to that. I don't know if you're dissuading me to encouraging me to change my
answer. I wanted to really make sure you didn't misinterpret it. That's all.
Yeah, it's not obvious.
You can tell Steve's a doctor because he keeps saying trimester instead of semester.
I know.
That's awesome.
You know, schools do go to trimesters sometimes.
Yeah, some do. That's true.
My grad school had trimesters.
Well, I don't think that threw me off, Steve. I think I'm kind of, for the most part, on the same wavelength with that and how you described it. Thank you for clarifying. I'll keep my answer the same.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could make, for the first one, you could make sense of the idea that negative emotions will motivate you to perform better. I don't think you would necessarily wallow in your pity party and not study, but who knows? I mean, this wouldn't surprise me either way. Let's see. Do not improve their problem-solving skills after the first semester. Yeah, I could see that, you know, all the problem-solving improvement you're going to get done that first semester, and you're just going to get into your rut and your habits and not necessarily do any better in getting things done, which I'm equating with problem-solving skills, and that assumption may be wrong as well. The third one, gesturing or not gesturing, and what's the connection with creativity? I actually read this article, and I totally forget what it was. So it could be either one, just either one. Nothing, it's not sticking out. I read it like days ago. It's not sticking out in my head one way or the other. So it's like, oh, crap. That really pisses me off when that happens. But I'm going to say you flipped it. I'm going to say you flipped that one, whatever the hell it is, and say that the gesturing is fiction.
Okay, Kara?
I think on this one I'm going to go with Evan, and just to explain why a little bit, this is the kind of science or fiction where the more I think about it, the more I talk myself into random explanations for answers. Yeah. So I think I have to sort of go with my top line instincts based on previous knowledge. So the first one being that college students who are dealing with mood issues like stress and negative emotions actually perform better than their happy peers. I think other evidence would support this. Individuals are more likely to go to the doctor if they have a negative outlook or if they're pessimistic. So they often have better health outcomes. I think it might be the same situation here, that it could be a motivating factor to actually do better in school. And that sometimes just being happy-go-lucky means that you don't think you need to try as hard. The middle item, which is the one that I'm going to say is the fiction, most undergraduate students do not improve their problem-solving skills after the first semester. It just seems a little bit random to me that it would be within the first semester they develop good problem-solving skills. Generally speaking, the first semester of college is just orienting to college. So I don't know. I could see that college is not very good for problem solving skills in general. We talk about that all the time on the show, that we don't do a good enough job helping teach how to think. But I'm not sure what that first semester would have to do with anything. And then the final one, children who gesture more or encouraged to gesture more are more creative than those who gesture less. The wording "are more creative" that bothers me about this. I also feel like this is pop psychology that could very easily not be validated if another study were performed in the same vein. But I'm not surprised if a single study were published with these outcomes. So because of that, I'm going to say the problem solving skills improving after the first semester is the fiction.
Okay, so you all agree on the first one, so we'll start there. A study of college students finds an inverse relationship between mood and academic achievement, with those reporting more stress and negative emotions performing better than their happy peers. You all think that one is science, and that one is the fiction.
Wow!
Oh, no!
Is it really?
It
you
is.
Got a sweep.
You suck.
Wow.
Sweep. At the
wow.
end of your sweep. This is one where, you know, I don't know if any of you read the article, but the headline is misleading.
No.
And so if you just read the headline, you would have been screwed, because the headline says feeling bad has academic benefits. But what they're talking about is that if you're happy most of the time and you have occasional bouts of bad feelings, that could be associated with the highest academic success.
Mm.
If you're sad most of the time, those students are not doing well.
Yeah, because they just don't have motivation.
Yeah, or they're depressed, or they're whatever. They're just not. They're struggling. The students who are happy most of the time are the ones that are doing well. But it is okay to be occasionally stressed. You know, that's fine.
Of course.
And for the reasons that you said, so really it was just a matter of proportion, you know. But the headline focuses on the occasional bouts of feeling bad rather than, but you still have to be happy most of the time. You know, it's there isn't an inverse relationship. There's a direct correlation between being happy and doing well. But again, occasional stress is fine. So that was the bottom line of that study.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. I mean, I guess it does make perfect sense. It's all a matter of the degree to which like, obviously negative emotions can be helpful until they're not.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But let's move on to number two. A new study finds that most undergraduate students do not improve their problem-solving skills after the first trimester. That, of course, is science. They define problem-solving skills, Bob, as the ability to solve a situation in which you don't have all the information and you have to sort of think in new ways.
That's completely unreasonable.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
So, like there's something, the answer's not right in front of you. You have to fix a problem and you need to think about, come up with new and creative solutions in order to be able to solve that problem, which is, you know, a very sought after skill in the job market, apparently, you know, and it makes sense. Generic problem solving skills is a good thing to have. What the researchers found when they did a standardized test of problem solving skills, looking at students throughout their college career, that in the first trimester, students increased their problem-solving performance on this standardized measure by about 10%. And then after that, it was flatline. They had no further improvement for the rest of their undergraduate career in most disciplines. You know, there was a couple that had a little bit of improvement, but for most of them, you know, it doesn't matter what you were studying, you know, for the vast majority of the disciplines, there was really no improvement.
That's horrible.
Yeah, it's horrible. Yeah. And what they were focusing on in the write-up was that the standard teaching format of lecturing doesn't work. And that's nothing new. That is nothing new.
Yeah, right.
The data has been accumulating for years that lecturing is perhaps the least effective way of teaching, even though that's mostly what we do. Although I know this because in my medical school at Yale, we've been desperately trying to move away from lectures because it's a really ineffective way of transmitting information. The other thing is that students can, if they want lectures, they could watch videos and listen to podcasts, and they don't need to have a person, a warm body standing in front of them lecturing at them. When you get students in a classroom, they need to do stuff. You know, they need to be problem solving. They need to be working together and using the information. But just lecturing live to students is probably a complete waste of time.
I would doodle. That's wonderful. When that would happen,
absolutely.
You know? I would lose myself in a sense.
In my experience when I was teaching, I taught a lot of labs. I taught a few lectures, but I would find that when I was teaching lab, the students really didn't get some of the concepts they learned in lecture until they applied them
exactly.
in lab. So a common refrain would be, "Oh, now I get
it." Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's right. I mean, all of my student teaching is either like a one-on-one mentoring or even when I have groups, it's all labs. It's all, let's talk. Tell me what you think. You know, let's work our way through this problem. Let's think about this case. It's not, you know, we just don't spend any of our time lecturing at students anymore. It's totally ineffective. So I was not surprised by this. And I think, you know, the more wake-up calls we have to the education infrastructure to, you know, get with the program, you know, and start to really radically change the way we're transmitting information, the better. Okay, and this all that means that researchers find that children who gesture more or were encouraged to gesture more are more creative than those who gesture less. That is science. This is interesting. So first, what the scientists did is they just – these are children largely 9 to 11, and they would name an object for them like a teapot. And they would say, tell me all the ways in which you can use a teapot. And it was open-ended, which concerned me a little bit, I have to say, because anytime research protocols are open-ended, it opens the door for the people doing the study to subconsciously influence the outcome. But anyway, that point aside, they basically would say, would keep asking children, what else could you do with it? Well, what else could you do with it? Until they ran out of ideas. Now, they looked at children who naturally just would gesture, who would like mime what they were doing with the teapot, and they came up with more ideas. They were more creative than those children who didn't gesture with their hands while they were thinking through what they could do with a teapot or whatever, you know, the object was. Then they encouraged children, show me with your hands what you think you could do with it. And they came up with more items when they were encouraged to gesture with their hands. They also then put mittens on the students' hands so that they couldn't use them as effectively to gesture.
Aww.
But that did not have a negative impact on their creativity. For whatever reason, that wasn't enough, I guess, to inhibit, you know, their creativity. But there was in those two studies, you know, either spontaneous or encouraged gesturing, you know, and it makes sense because the specific task they were given was to imagine how they could use a three-dimensional object. And if they're sort of thinking through it by miming with their hands what they could do, just new things presented themselves to the children. So they were able to think of new things. It sparked their imagination as they were trying to imagine what they could do with it. That makes sense. That's actually not that surprising an outcome. But it is interesting that the broader question of how much of our physical movements are involved in our communication, our language, and therefore our cognition, because there is this strong connection between language and cognition. You wonder, like, you know, there are theories about language may have evolved out of nonverbal communication with our body, you know, with our hands or whatever.
Yeah. And it's also not even movement as a as just a motor function, but movement almost as a way to learn about our environment. You know, when I used to see kids in the clinical neuropsychologist's office who were blind or partially blind, these kids touch everything. Yeah. And they use their hands all the time when they talk, and they're just constantly moving their hands around, and it really helps them get a good representation of their world. Of course, we get to rely on our eyes, but it does make you wonder how much just having your hands being able to move and touch and feel and interact also helps you just with your insight, like with learning about the world, not to mention with then communicating with other people.
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, if you're interfacing with the world tactily, that you're going to use that a lot. Yeah. And even in your communication or as you're thinking. And it's funny, it's a little cultural, you know, the Italians have a reputation for speaking with their hands. And that matches my anecdotal experience, I'll say, as an Italian American.
Santa Maria Novella.
Yeah, right. I mean,
maybe we'll touch on this again when we talk about Arrival.
Oh,
you'll see.
Nice foreshadowing.
Maybe.
For me.
Maybe that's true. Yeah, maybe. That's absolutely true. So we're planning on reviewing the movie Arrival next week. we'll see how that goes. Very good movie, but we'll talk about it next week. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Here it is. It's the only appropriate quote for this week. The most important thing we can do is inspire young minds and to advance the kind of science, math, and technology education that will help youngsters take us to the next phase of space travel. As quoted in Space All, Systems Go for National Space Day at CNN on May 4th, 2000 by John Glenn.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, yep. That's a good quote from John Glenn. Very appropriate. Thanks,
yeah,
Evan.
Yeah, wholly appropriate. Thanks.
All right, guys. So, actually, just a few hours after this show goes up, we'll be recording the year-end review episode. We're going to be live streaming it on our Facebook page starting at 2 p.m. Eastern time. If everything works, you know, we'll be streaming it somewhere. Our plan is to stream it on Facebook. We'll probably use a YouTube stream if that fails because we haven't done Facebook before. But we think it's going to work. But it will start at 2 p.m. either way. And that'll be out, probably go to around 5 p.m. And that will also be our year-end in review episode, which we'll put up in 2 weeks because we still have one more regular show to do this year.
And again, that's Eastern time,
yeah, it's all
right?
Eastern time.
11 for people on the West Coast.
Yeah, exactly. We'll actually be seeing you guys all on Saturday for that. Carrie will be joining us virtually over Skype. But that worked out fine last time.
Going to be fun.
Yep, should be fun.
Yep.
So thank you guys for joining me this week.
Thanks,
sure,
Scott.
Man. Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.